Let's take our Bibles this morning and turn to Genesis, the first chapter. Now, I'm not going to read anything from here to begin with, but just to get you prepared. Genesis chapter 1, and we'll read from it in just a minute. I'm going to start a series this morning, and in actuality, it's going to be a repeat of a previous series I did here and have in the very beginning of the tape ministry, made available on the tape ministry. The reasons I'm going to do a repeat of this series is twofold. One, the quality of the previous series is so poor that every time I send out the tapes, when they're ordered, I have to apologize for the quality and so forth. And it was done at a time before we had better taping equipment or recording equipment, when I used to just have my portable tape recorder up here. So the quality of those tapes is very poor. It was also done in a class setting rather than in a message series. And sometimes the audience participation is so low that you can't hear it, so that makes it of poor quality as well. As well as there are some corrections that also needed to be made in this series. Now, I apologize to you in one sense that you're going to hear this series again, and we've talked about it at different times. But in another sense, I don't apologize because Peter, I'm glad he stated this, that there's times when we need to be, or you need to be reminded of things you've heard before. This is one of those things I think that we do need to be reminded on, because again, it's one of those things that I think that our people have taken one line of thinking on it, and I believe, and I'm open to correction on this, but I believe that it has not been correct. And I believe that God has certainly opened the doors of knowledge to us in many different areas. But that doesn't mean that everything that we teach or believe is infallible. And I believe here's one of the places that we've made a mistake in this particular area. This will be the multiple creations theory under scrutiny, part one. At this time, there seems to be a growing number, and even more so than when I first presented this series, there appears to be a growing number of Christian leaders who are expounding a doctrine regarding the creation account of the Bible, which is quite different. Matter of fact, in some way, totally opposed to the traditional interpretation and understanding of Genesis 1 and 2. Rather than teaching one creation from the book of Genesis, they propound two or more creations, believing, for example, that an Adamic race of man was created in Genesis 2 after the creation of the other races of men in Genesis 1. And there is a big question. There is certainly a tremendous question here, or a great question that needs to be answered, and that's where all of this comes from, and that is, where do the other races come from? Where do they originate? Now, first of all, let me state this. It is not my intent in this series to necessarily debate whether there were other races created before Adam and Eve. Okay, that is not necessarily the intent of this passage, but I will be raising the question as to whether the origin of the other races is found in the Scriptures or not, specifically in Genesis chapter 1, whether that is where we have the description or the explanation of where the other races came from. Now, this is the order that I intend to follow in this series of messages. I intend to proceed first in revealing how and where the other races did not originate. Secondly, I intend to answer the objections and questions that are often raised concerning the position that the creationists take, or let me not, because I don't take necessarily the same position the creationists take, but the position of only one creation is found in both Genesis 1 and Genesis 2. I intend to, secondly, answer those questions and objections. So hang on, because I know when I go through the first part of this, don't rule this all out, because I intend to get to those questions. I know about the questions. You know, what about the different order of events in Genesis 1 compared to or contrasted with the different order, quote-unquote, of events in Genesis 2? And what about the different prohibitions on food in Genesis 1 and Genesis 2. I know I think I know pretty well just about all of them. Somebody may come up with one or two I haven't considered yet. But I'm fairly certain that I know all of those objections and or questions, and I intend to address those questions and objections as we get further into the series. So as we're going through this first part, I ask you not to rule this whole theory out because I'm not dealing with the questions specifically. I will deal with them. And then thirdly, I intend to postulate where and how these other races might have originated. Now, why has it become so? Why has it become popular or even important in certain circles for some to establish a multiple multiple creations in Genesis 1 and 2? Well, generally, I don't question either the sincerity or the integrity of those who perpetuate such a doctrine, though there are some exceptions. I have come across my desk, either tapes or videos, one particular individual in particular that propounds this multiple creation theory, and in one particular area of it, he has been plumb dishonest with what he has taught in regards to certain words as found in Genesis 1 and Genesis 2. He's either been dishonest or he gathered the material from somebody else who was dishonest and didn't check it out. It's one of those two things. So there are exceptions. But overall, I don't question the sincerity or the integrity of the peoples who are perpetuating this doctrine. Rather, I believe that their teaching has originated because of the perplexing questions and problems that seem to be unanswered and usually are unanswered by the conventional interpretation of Genesis 1 and 2. Now, here are what I believe the three most important, or three of the more important questions that certainly seem to go unanswered by most of creationism today. Number one, how could different races come from two racially identical parents? Very legitimate question to ask. Is that question being legitimately answered by modern-day creationists today? No, it's not. So here's the second question. The second question being, if mankind or all the races came from common ancestors, then the popular philosophy of contemporary times known as the brotherhood of mankind, quote unquote, has validity. How then can interracial marriages be condemned by God as they are in the scriptures? Good question to be asked if we all originated from the same common parents. And then the third question being, where did Cain get his wife? And if she simply was an unmentioned sister in Genesis 1 or Genesis 2, what about the biblical injunction against incest? And again, there is certainly that biblical injunction as well. And if he took a sister, it certainly looks like he would have transgressed that biblical injunction against incest. So there's three questions, and I know there are a whole lot more as well. But those are three of the major questions that again seem to be unanswered by conventional creationism today, who take the conventional approach to Genesis 1 and Genesis 2. As a result, it is my belief that well-meaning brethren have wrested the Scriptures, specifically Genesis 1 and 2, and have forced them to say something they don't say in order to answer these questions. That is, that there was a pre-Adamic creation of different races in Genesis 1 prior to the creation of Adam and his race in Genesis 2 in order to solve these problems. Now, let me mention, as I did when I previously gave this series of messages, that when I first came to understand our identity, that the Anglo-Saxon, Germanic, Scandinavian, and kindred peoples are the Israelites of old, the Israelites of new, from the Israelites of old, I guess you'd say. When I came to understand that, when I came to understand that God still had a plan for physical Israel, and I came to understand who Israel is today, one of the first things that, in that understanding that came along with it, was this multiple creation theory. And again, it did seem to answer a lot of those unanswered questions that just kind of get passed by, usually in the past. But I decided that this was too important of a topic or discussion for me just to accept the teaching of others that I had heard on this subject that sounded good and that sounded even scriptural. from what I had heard and what I could see that they and how they presented it. But I decided it's too important, it's too foundational of a doctrine for us, for me just to accept that, and so I said, I've got to study this out myself. But I want you to know that I went into the study hoping that what they were propounding was true. Because again, it did seem to answer certain questions, certain unanswered questions. But as I went into the study, being honest with what I found in the Scriptures, I found that somebody did not dig deep enough. Or the people who are propounding this dual creation or multiple creation theory, as is propounded in our movement, that they didn't dig deep enough and that they didn't study it out further enough to understand exactly what is happening in these passages. Now, let me begin by admitting that Genesis 1, verses 1 through 2a, could possibly be the creation and destruction of a former civilization on earth. In other words, I admit that there's the possibility that there was another creation of everything, including human beings, that was prior to the creation of Adam, but that it was also destroyed. I admit that that is a possibility found in Genesis 1, verses 1 and or through 2a. Let's go to Genesis chapter 1. Verse 1, it says, "In the beginning God created the heavens and the earth." And then verse 2, it says, "And the earth was formless and void." Let's stop right there. Now, there is the possibility here in this first part of verse 2 that there's one particular word that has not been translated very well. There's a couple words, but I want to just kind of focus in on one. It's the word "was," and the earth was formless and void. That word is used 67 times also in the Scriptures as "became." Now, let me read it with that word, starting with verse 1. "In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth." Verse 2, "And the earth became formless and void." In other words, or uninhabited, there are some other ways that those other words could be translated. But the point being is that there is that possibility that is how those first two verses can be understood, that there was a previous creation and that it was destroyed. Now, but let it be understood that this possible creation here would have no bearing on the discussion at hand. See, I wanted to deal with that because somebody says, well, there was another creation. Even if you are able to show us that in Genesis 1, the other races are certainly not being discussed or described as being created in Genesis 1, we still have this other creation in Genesis 1 and 2a that's very possibly being described here. But the point is that even though that possibly did happen that way, it has no bearing on the discussion at hand. Why? Well, because no one would have lived through the total destruction of this proposed civilization, because the rest of verse 2 describes a worldwide flood. Look at the rest of verse 2. It says, "And darkness was over the surface of the deep, and the Spirit of God was moving over the surface of the waters." Even if there was a creation prior to the one described in the rest of Genesis 1 and 2, even if there were other people, other races created during that time, they obviously would have been destroyed in this worldwide flood of Genesis chapter 1, verse 2 and 2b. Does that make sense? Okay, it needed to be addressed. Somebody just all they have to do is think it through and they'll realize, hey, that can't come up with the other races over there. Even if they were created at that time, they were destroyed as well. Therefore, the origin of the other races of mankind cannot be found in this contested scenario. Consequently, if the creation of the other races is to be found in Genesis 1, it has to be found after Genesis 1, 2a. Okay? Has to be found after that destruction as described, or that worldwide flood as described in Genesis 1 and verse 2. This leaves us with three other choices in the remainder of Genesis 1, whereby we might find the other races of mankind, if indeed the other races of mankind are mentioned at all in Genesis 1. Turn to Genesis 1, verses 24 through 26, and we'll find those three other possibilities of where we might find the other races of mankind being described. Genesis 1, starting with verse 24, it says, "Then God said, let the earth bring forth living creatures after their kind, cattle and creeping things, and beasts of the earth after their kind, and it was so. And God made the beasts of the earth after their kind, and the cattle after their kind, and everything that creeps on the ground after their kind, and God saw that it was good. Then God said, let us make man in our image, according to our likeness, and let them rule over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the sky, and over the cattle, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth." Within those three verses, we can find three different possibilities wherein the creation of the other races are described. There are three possibilities that are used today to say, here is the explanation of where the other races came from. First of all, it possibly may be, as found in verse 26, the word man, as found in the word man there, that the word man in Genesis 1, verse 26, is the creation of the other races. Secondly, it could possibly be found, or it's purported to be found, in the phrase, the living creatures, as found in verse 24, I believe. Or some even go as far as to say or purport that it's found, the other races, the creation of the other races, is found in the phrase, beasts of the earth, as described in verse 25. So there are the three possibilities, the only other three possibilities, now that we've done away with this previous possible creation and destruction of a previous civilization, these are really the only three possibilities of finding the creation of the other races in Genesis chapter 1. And I have never heard anybody else purport any others. So I think we can pretty safely say that these are the only three. If we're going to find them in Genesis 1, it has to either be found in man, the living creatures, or the beasts of the field. Let's begin by looking at man. Genesis 1:26 once again says, "Then God said, let us make man in our image, according to our likeness, and let them rule over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the sky, and over the cattle, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth." There, man is first time that man is brought into the picture of Genesis 1. Man is here. God says, let us make man in his image. But what is this man that he's talking about? Who is this man? The man of Genesis 1 is actually the most often chosen to be the creation of the other races of mankind. And yet, of all the choices, it is the easiest to put to rest. It's very simple to put to rest the fact that the word man here in Genesis 1 can be the creation of the other races. One need only to examine the word translated man in Genesis 1 and the word translated Adam in Genesis 2, and we discover that they are both, translated from the same identical Hebrew word, Adam. That's number 120 in Strong's Concordance. Strong's defines it as from 119, ruddy, that is a human being, an individual or species, mankind, etc. Strong's Concordance. Now, he said that number 120 comes from 119. 119 is also a word pronounced Adam, and it is defined as to show blood in the face, that is flush or turn rosy. Now, here's the point of all of this. Whatever Adam is in Genesis 2, and again, people have wanted to make a distinction between the Adam of Genesis 2 and the man of Genesis 1, but whatever Adam is in Genesis 2, man is in Genesis 1. If Adam in Genesis 2 is a white man who blushes, then man in Genesis 1 is a white man who blushes. And there's no way around that, because it's the exact same identical word translated man in Genesis 1 and Adam in Genesis 2. It is evident that it was simply the choice of the translators to translate Adam into man in Genesis 1 and Adam into Adam in Genesis 2. In one place they chose, say, we're just going to label it here as man, as it is most often translated throughout the Hebrew Old Testament scriptures. But they said, now when it comes to Genesis 2, we're going to translate it Adam. We're going to give it a name. Now, you know the reason I think that they did that? I don't know because I haven't talked to them, but I suspect this is the reason they do that. They did that, and that is because, and I will prove this point, that is because Genesis 1 is describing the overall creation of God, starting with the darkness and light and so forth and so on, creating the waters, creating the expanse between the waters, creating the dry land and then the plants and so forth, and then the animals and then man. And man at this point in Genesis 1 is just one particular part, not even dealt with in a very special way, though somewhat more special in Genesis 1. But specifically, as you look at all of Genesis 1, it's just one particular part of the whole creation. Wherein, as I will prove, Genesis 2 is magnifying that which in Genesis 1 was the most important aspect of the creation. And that is man. And thus, all of a sudden, now they give this man, at least it's my opinion, this is why the translators did it, is that they then give him a name, because he's really being centered in Genesis chapter 2. And if you look at it that way, it'll answer many of those questions that seem to be, or what seems to be confusing between Genesis 1 and Genesis 2, and we will deal with that more specifically. But the point is that it was simply the choice of the translators to translate it man in Genesis 1 and verse 26 and Adam in Genesis 2. In other words, Genesis 1:26 could have legitimately been just as legitimately translated, "Then God said, let us make Adam in our image." Now, you think had the translators done that, and I certainly wish they had, I don't think there had ever been a question. Nobody would have ever tried to have made man the creation of the other races had Genesis 1:26 been translated, "Let us make Adam instead of man in our image." And it could have, keep it in mind, that it could have been translated that way. There's no reason it shouldn't have been. Thus, it could have been, and had it been, nobody would have ever came up with man being the creation of the other races. I'm totally confident of that. Now, that in itself, right there, we can stop the message on man right there. That in itself proves that man in Genesis 1, verse 26, cannot be the creation of the other races. Whatever man is in Genesis 1, 26, Adam is in Genesis 2. So if you want to make man into the other races of mankind, non-white races, then you have to do the same with the Adam of Genesis 2. It works both ways. That would take care of it. But there are some who have come up with some different twists to try to take care of this problem. Others, understanding the problem created by the Hebrew word Adam, used in Genesis 1:26, maintain that the man or Adam of Genesis 1 is the creation of the Adamic race, plural, and that the Adam of Genesis 2 is a specific creation and calling of an individual Adam. So now they say, okay, well, now we know where Cain would have got his wife, because we've got the creation of the Adamic race, plural, in Genesis 1, and then a specific calling of a special Adam in Genesis 2. Again, keep in mind, those words cannot be differentiated at all. They're the same two words in both passages in the Hebrew. But that's an interesting thought. At least they've recognized that man in Genesis 1 cannot be the other races. Though, I must say, there are some who say that Adam here, or Adam here, I should say, from the Hebrew, in Genesis 1:26 is not only the creation of a white race, but it's also the creation of all the other races as well. So they still try to stretch it and make it be the creation of other races. But at the very least, we can say maybe it could be the creation of a plurality of Adamic man. But there's no way that it could be the creation of these other races unless we agree that all the other races were white men who could blush. Because it's the same word and it means the same thing. They both come, it's number 120, Adam, which come from the Hebrew word 119, which means to show red in the face. So it's just an impossibility. It's just a means of trying to stretch it to make it work, and it won't work, as we will see as we continue to go on. Now here's the reason, or why they try to say or how they can attempt to say that the man of Genesis 1:26 is a plurality of people. in trying to teach that the Adam of Genesis 1 is plural, their arguments go like this. They start with Genesis 1:27. Let me read it again. It says, "And God created man in his own image. In the image of God he created him. Male and female he created them." Here's their argument. First note, the word "them" in this passage in Genesis 1 and verse 27. Consequently, we observe here that a plurality of atoms, both male and female, were created at the same time. Whereas in Genesis 2, Adam was created and then Eve at a later time. And so they say, hey, here's a plurality, here's a singular creation over in Genesis 2. Then they also, and this is kind of a new twist added to this that I've only heard one man purport, but it's an interesting thought. This particular man used Genesis 2:1. There it says, "Thus the heavens and the earth were completed, and all their hosts." Now I want you to, without being influenced by the reasoning and thinking here, I want you to, again, as I'm going to read it again, let me read the first verse of chapter 2 again, and I want you to interpret what you believe that has meant always in the past to you. "Thus the heavens and the earth were completed, and all their hosts." Okay, the follow-up, obviously, of chapter 1, the creation of all the creation. Now, just hold that thought. What does that mean to you? Hold that thought, and we'll come back to it. Now, here's an actual quote of the explanation of Genesis 2 and verse 1. In trying to prove that the creation of Adam in Genesis 1 was the creation of a plurality of either, this particular man takes the position that it was not only of the white race, but of all the other races as well. Here's what he said, quote, "In Genesis 2:1, we are told that there was a host of them at the end of the sixth day. The word host is word number 6635, of course from Strong's Concordance, and means a mass of persons," end quote. So that's his position. See, now we've got a plurality of people in Genesis 1:27. Genesis 2:1, at the end of the 6 days, we have a mass of persons. Thus, again, further establishing that this creation of Adam in Genesis 1 is a plurality of people. Now, let me deal with these two arguments as found from these two different passages. Let's begin with Genesis 1:27. Granted, the word "them" is used, which certainly implies plurality. No question about that. There's no way to get around that in the Hebrew. There is a word used, the word "them," that indeed implies plurality. But let me ask, what is meant by that scripture when it uses that word "them" in that plural sense? Let's go to Genesis chapter 5, and let's see if we can't find ourselves an answer. Genesis 5, I want to read verses 1 through 4. Verse 1, "This is the book of the generations of Adam. In the day when God created man, he made him in the likeness of God. He created them male and female, and he blessed them and named them man in the day when they were created. When Adam had lived 130 years, he became the father of a son in his own likeness, according to his image, and named him Seth. Then the days of Adam after he became the father of Seth were 800 years, and he had other sons and daughters." Now, before we dig into this, let me ask this question. Which Adam, I have to put that in quotes, which Adam is being dealt with in this passage? The Adam of Genesis 1 or the Adam of Genesis 2? Which is being dealt with? Now, you already know that I believe that there's no difference between the two. But looking at it from their perspective, okay, we're looking at it through their eyes, which Adam is being dealt with in this passage? Well, go to verse 3, and I think it very clearly describes which Adam is being dealt with from their perspective. Verse 4, "Then the days of Adam after he became the father of Seth were 800 years, and he had other sons and daughters." Thus, based on verse 4, those purport that this differentiation between the Adam of Genesis 1 and the Adam of Genesis 2, they would have to say that this passage is dealing with the Adam of Genesis 2, right? Because only that Adam would be the father of Seth. But I want you to note that this passage is also dealing with the Adam of Genesis 1 as well. Look at verse 1. It says, "This is the book of the generations of Adam. In the day when God created man, he made him in the likeness of God." Where does that come from? Turn to Genesis 1 and verse 26, keeping in mind what I just read from Genesis 5 and verse 1. Genesis 1, verse 26, "Then God said, let us make man in our image according to our likeness." Go back to Genesis 5. This is the book of the generations of Adam. In the day when God created man, he made him in the likeness of God. Very clearly, verse 1 is dealing with the quote-unquote Adam of Genesis 1. Not only that, look at verse 2. It says, "He created them, male and female, and he blessed them." Where does that come from? Well, that's nearly a word-for-word quote from Genesis 1, 27 and 28. Go back. Verse 27, "And God created man in his own image. In the image of God he created him. Male and female he created them, and God blessed them." Consequently, without a question, it is here evident from Genesis 5, verses 1 through 4, that the Scriptures view Genesis 1 and Genesis 2 as two different presentations of the same account. Not two different creations, just simply two different presentations, two different viewpoints of the same account that happened at the beginning of creation. Now, I believe Genesis 2 does go on into actually what I believe is probably a second week as well. But basically, it's still dealing with, as both describes the creation of Adam, or Adam in the Hebrew, they are both describing the same identical account, and this proves it. And you know what else? So do, not only do the Scriptures, and there are other, we're going to look at this in more detail in a future message. Not only does this place link Genesis 1 and Genesis 2 and put them together as if they were one and the same thing, which they are, there's another place even in the New Testament that does the same thing. But not only that, so do the book of Jubilees, and so does the book of Jasher as well. Now, I want to share with you, we'll look at Jasher in another message, but I want to share with you from the book of Jubilees how the book of Jubilees interprets Genesis 1 and Genesis 2 in this regard, or related to this particular question that we're examining. I want to go to Jubilees chapter 2, and I'm going to skip around a little bit. I want to start with verse 1. Now, Jubilees 2, you need to understand this. And let me say this before I get into the book of Jubilees. I want you to know I do not view the book of Jubilees in any way as being inspired Scripture. I do not believe that it is. But nonetheless, it is interesting, no matter at what time it was written. Some believe that it was written in the first century A.D. Some believe that it was written before that. Whichever. Even though I don't view this as inspired Scripture, I do feel that it's interesting to see how these people, whoever wrote this, viewed these two creation accounts at the time they wrote them, which was at least 2,000 or more years back. Okay, so it does bear at least would qualify for interest in that regard. Jubilees 2 is in essence a parallel of Genesis 1. It goes through it almost in the same sequential way, a day-by-day-by-day sequence of the creation, with some extra added, much the same way that Jasher often adds in things that were unsaid or left out in the book of Genesis. Now, I want to go through the different days, and you can see how it parallels perfectly with Genesis chapter 1. Genesis chapter 2, starting with verse 1, it says, "And the angel of the face spoke to Moses by the command of the Lord, saying, write all the words of creation, how in 6 days the Lord God finished all the works which he created and rested on the seventh day and sanctified it for all the years and established it as a sign for all his works. For on the first day he created the heavens above and the earth and the waters." Then let me pick it up in verse 3. "And on the second day," so parallels perfectly with the first day, second day. Verse 3, "On the second day he made a firmament between the waters, and the waters divided on this day, and half of it ascended upward, and half of it descended beneath the firmament over the face of the earth, and this work alone was made on the second day. Verse 4, on the third day he did as he said to the waters, that they should cross from the face of the whole earth to one place, and that dry land should appear. Verse 6, and on that day he created for it the water, the abysses of the sea,
seas, according to their separate gathering places, and all the rivers, and the gathering places of the waters, and the hills, and in all the earth, and all the lakes, and all the dew of the earth, and the seed which is sown according to its kind, and everything that is eaten, and the trees which bear fruit, and the wild trees in the Garden of Eden for pleasure, and all these four great creations he made on the third day. Again, perfect harmony with Genesis 1. Verse 7, and on the fourth day he made the sun and moon and stars and placed them in the firmament of heaven, and that they should shine over the earth and rule over day and night, and to divide between night and day and between darkness and light. Again, harmony with Genesis 1. Verse 11, and on the fifth day he created the great animals in the abysses of the seas, for these were the first things of flesh created by his hands, and everything that moves in the waters, and the fishes, and everything that flies, the birds and their whole kind. Again, in perfect harmony. 13, and on the sixth day he made all the animals of the earth, and all the beasts, and everything that moves over the earth. And then verse 14. Now keep in mind, I skipped around just to get the day sequence here and to show what the book of Jubilee says was created on each day in perfect harmony. I did so to show that it's in perfect harmony with the book of Genesis, or Genesis chapter 1. Now, everything's been in harmony. Now listen to what else is stated. Verse 14. And after this he made mankind, a single one, male and female, he created them. Now it says, in perfect harmony with Genesis 1, but it adds that one point, that he made a single one, not a plurality of people, a single one, male and female, he created them. Now somebody could contest that and say, what do you mean a single one? There was a male and a female. If nothing else, at least implies plurality. Well, now let's jump over to chapter 2, which is looking back, I believe, on, it's looking back on what was stated in Genesis 1, what was stated in Jubilees 2 or Genesis 1. It's kind of like what chapter 2 does, looking back again. And listen to one of the statements and footnotes in this chapter. Chapter 3 of Jubilees, verse 7, listen to what it says. And in the first seventh, now what it means by seventh, the first seventh here is in the first week. Now, chapter 2 is specifically dealing with the second week, so it's looking back on the first week of creation. It says, and in the first seventh was Adam created, and his wife in his side. And in the second seventh, he showed her to him. And then it continues. Now, let me read it again. And in the first seventh was Adam created, and his wife still in his side. I added the word still there, but that's what it's implying. And in the second seventh, the second week, he showed her to him. He brought her out, created her from his rib. Here's the footnote. It says, that is, she was created at the same time with Adam, but in and within him, and it was only in the second week that she became a separate creature. Now, I find that very interesting. Again, I don't see it inspired, but it certainly has implication by the very latest it was written was A.D., or the first century A.D. And that's how they viewed what was being said in Genesis 1 and verse 26 and 27. Now, in light of that, let's go back to Genesis 1, 27 and see if it doesn't sound like that's exactly what it's saying. Matter of fact, before I'd ever read the book of Jubilees, before I'd ever heard a multiple creations theory, this is what I thought it said. Read Genesis 1, 27 now with me, in light of how the Jubilees just explained it. Verse 27, and God created man in his own image. In the image of God he created him. Male and female, he created them. Well, which is it? Him or them? You know, he first says he created him, and then all of a sudden now he's creating them. Well, it was both. Just as it is explained in the footnote in the book of Jubilees, chapter 3. He created. Eve was there. She was obviously there the whole time, even though she wasn't in her final form. She was still within man as a part of the creation. He had created them both right there when he created the one in the second week, or whenever it was. Jubilees could be wrong in the second week. But whenever it was, he just brought her out and finalized her form. Does that make sense? Go back to Genesis 5, verses 1 and 2. And it
proves the same thing as well. Again, it says, this is the book of the generations of Adam in the day when God created man. Genesis 1, 26, when he created him. Okay? Very similar. This is the book of the generations of Adam. In the day when God created man, he made him in the likeness of God. Verse 2, he created them, male and female, and he blessed them and named them man. And then it goes right on into showing that this same man is the Adam of Genesis 2, who was the father of the man named Seth. It works out perfectly. And there can be no question that Genesis 1 is dealing with a plurality of people. It's dealing only with a plurality of people, as that Adam kind was found in the original creation of the Adam man, even as Eve was, and they became the progenitors of at least the white race. We'll deal with where the other races came along the way here as we get further into this series. But right now we're dealing with who wasn't created, and in this particular message, who wasn't created when man was created, and it certainly was not the other races, and it wasn't a plurality of people created at the same time as well. Now, let's also examine their Genesis 2:1 argument. Remember, it was stated that the word host in Genesis 2:1 means a mass of persons, at least by this particular individual I quoted, as found in Strong's Concordance's definition. And thus it is concluded that the creation of Adam man in Genesis 1 had to be a plurality of people, even in this particular man's case, a number of different races of people. But in reading Genesis 2:1, as I ask you to do with me, in and by itself, I am confident, you tell me if otherwise, but I am confident that no one would interpret the host in Genesis 2:1 as meaning only or exclusively humans. Have you ever read Genesis? Anybody ever read Genesis 2:1 just in reading and thought, well, that's talking about humans there when it says the host of the heavens or the host of the earth and the heavens? Anybody here? Small audience, but nonetheless, I think it's probably a good gauge. I mean, unless somebody points that out, I don't think anyone's going to come up with that the host there is talking about only human beings in that particular passage. Instead, I'm certain that it would be interpreted to mean all of the living creatures and bodies which God created in the heavens and the earth. That's how I've always looked at it in the past. Now, but let me state, even though you wouldn't look at it that way, even though I hadn't looked at it that way in the past, if the word host only means mass of persons, then we have no choice but to accept that interpretation of that passage. And that's what this man stated. That host there, number 6639, I think it was, means mass of persons. And if it only means that, that has to be our understanding of that passage. But there's the problem. The Hebrew word, which is tesaba, translated host in chapter 2, verse 1 of Genesis, means much more than just a mass of persons. Or I should say, it is scripturally used in reference to more than just a mass of persons. Strong's Concordance does define this word as a mass of persons. But the writer of that statement didn't quote all of Strong's definition as found in his concordance. Let me read all of it. It's, again, the word host, number 6635, from the Hebrew word tesaba. Here's how it's translated by Strong's. A mass of persons, or figuratively, things. Especially organized for war, an army, by implication, a campaign, literally or figuratively, specifically hardship and worship. So there's all of a sudden a broader meaning here, and I hope you caught the first pat. Not only massive persons, but also figuratively as things. It can be used in that sense. Jesenius' Hebrew Chaldee lexicon to the Old Testament gives the word a much broader definition than does Strong's, and uses it in reference to the sun, moon, and stars, or shows that scripturally it is used that way, as found in Jeremiah, if you turn there with me, Jeremiah chapter 33 and verse 22. Jeremiah 33 and verse 22, listen to what it says. As the host of heaven cannot be counted, and the sand of the sea cannot be measured, so I will multiply the descendants of David my servant and the Levites who minister to me.
What's it talking about here when it says the host of heaven? Well, of course, this is a reiteration of a promise to David that had earlier been given to Abraham. In Genesis 15:5, we find that particular promise to Abraham given, and here's what it says. And he took him outside and said, "Now look toward the heavens and count the stars. If you are able to count them," he said to him, "so shall your descendants be." In Genesis 15:5, it uses the word stars. In Jeremiah 33 and verse 22, it uses the word host. Thus we know the host here in this case is the stars of heaven. Look also to Deuteronomy chapter 4. And we find it even used in a broader way. Deuteronomy 4 and verse 19. It says, "And beware lest you lift up your eyes to heaven and see the sun and the moon and the stars, all the host of heaven." The host of heaven, the sun, the moon, and the stars. So all of a sudden, we're getting a little bit different outlook on this host in Genesis 2 and verse 1 is supposed to just be massive persons. Jesenius goes on to say that Genesis 2:1, passage under consideration here, that Genesis 2:1 is thus explained in Nehemiah 9:6, and then to also compare it with Exodus 20 and verse 11. Go to Nehemiah. Nehemiah chapter 9 and verse 6. It says, "Thou alone art Yahweh. Thou hast made the heavens, the heaven of heavens with all their hosts, the earth and all that is on it, the seas and all that is in them. Thou dost give life to all of them. The heavenly host bows down before thee." According to Jesenius, he says that this explains what is being talked about in Genesis chapter 2 and verse 1. And then he says, compare it with Exodus 20. Let's go to Exodus 20. Exodus chapter 20 and verse 11. There it says, "For in 6 days Yahweh made the heavens and the earth, the sea and all that is in them, and rested on the seventh day." Perfect parallel with Genesis 2:1. Because Genesis 2:1 is at the end of the sixth day, just before God went into the seventh day of His rest. What did He create? He created the heavens and the earth and the seas and everything that is in them. What is the host being described in Genesis 2:1? Well, consequently, with Jesenius' definition, with all of Strong's definition, and with the scriptures in mind, the word host in Genesis 2:1 refers not only to a mass of persons, it would include, well, I can't even say it's a mass of persons, can I? But we've already proved that there was no plurality to begin with. It would infer to the Adam who was created, and also to the whole creation that was created, to all that was involved in the heavens and the earth and the seas. And I think, again, that's the natural way we would always look at that passage. And I think now we have proof for accepting that that is the valid interpretation of that passage, rather than seeing it as a mass of persons, thus proving that the Adam of Genesis 1 was a plurality of people created. Now, it should also be recognized with all of this that the theory which maintains that the Adam of Genesis 1 is a plurality of people is basically irrelevant, and unnecessary if neither the living creatures nor the beast of the earth can be proven to be the creation of the other races. There's no reason to make the Adam of Genesis 1 plural if you can't prove that the living creatures or the beasts of the earth are the other races. There's no reason to purport such a thing. If there are not other races created in Genesis 1, then there is no reason not to accept the logical conclusion, that is, that the man of Genesis 1 and the Adam of Genesis 2 are the one and the same individual original man. And of course, we are going to be dealing with the living creatures and the beasts of the earth in future messages. If those two things can be proven to not be the creation of the other races, then there's no reason for us not to just say alike has been so often accepted. And just because conventional teaching has in many areas been proven to be wrong, as you dig deeper into the scriptures and as God opens and reveals them to our understanding, that doesn't mean that everything in conventional teaching is wrong. And sometimes, again, like the old proverbial
baby with the bathwater. We want to throw it out. We lose the baby too. In this case, I think our conventional way of looking upon this has been correct, and I think thus proven. Now, before I finish up this particular message, I want to share with you one new argument as well. This is one that just recently came across my desk from someone, and I don't need to mention who it was, but someone who recently listened to my previous Poor Quality series on this same subject. And this is part of his response to what he heard. I'm just going to read straight from his letter. He said, "Some of the most damaging studies to the one creation of man theory is the word ish. Hebrew, number 376, as opposed to the man, Hebrew 120. What's interesting is that the Garden of Eden man, 120, became an ish when the woman was taken from his body or rib." Now, let me state first, this is my contention, he was always an ish. It's just that that's the first time that need of mentioning it was made. That he was ish, and I forget, she was something ish. Woman means, anybody remember? I should have looked that up, I forget. Anyway, he cannot prove his point by what he stated there. It's just the first time that he was called that. Okay, it's just like in Genesis 1, God, I never thought about this, but in Genesis 1, God is addressed only as Elohim. In Genesis 2, he's called Yahweh Elohim. Does that mean that he wasn't Yahweh Elohim in Genesis 1? No, it just wasn't God's desire to call himself Yahweh Elohim until Genesis 2 and later. So no point can be made with that. But anyway, let's continue with his thought. He says, when the woman was taken from his body or rib, he says that what's interesting is that the Garden of Eden man, 120, became an ish when the woman was taken from his body or rib. Look up the use of ish throughout Scripture and note that the common sort, 120 man, is always used to label people of non-ish origin. This is the key to what distinguished the two. Okay, let's leave it right there for right now. He says, look up the word ish and you'll discover that it was always dealing with only the Adamic race, is basically what he was saying. So let's do just what he suggests. Keeping in mind that, again, he is saying, ish, according to this particular fella, is something or a designation which sets ish Adam apart from the common Adam, or the ish Adam of Genesis 2 apart from the common Adam of Genesis 1. Okay, can you follow that thinking there? He says the two should be set apart, and the rest of the Scriptures prove it. So I said, okay, let's go to the rest of the Scriptures. If this is the case, let's keep in mind also that that this is the only way that word can be used, is for ish Adam, as of Genesis 2, that it couldn't be used in other ways. Okay, let's consider some Scriptures. We'll have to do these quickly, so I'll just read them as I get to them. Genesis 7 and verse 2, we find the word ish used. Genesis 7, verse 2, it says, "You shall take with you of every clean animal by sevens, a male and his female, and of the animals that are not clean, too, a male and his female." The word male there is the word ish, being used for animals, not for any for mankind or any part of mankind. What it was, ish was simply a designation to distinguish between male and female. That's all it was. We can see the same thing in Leviticus chapter 13 in regards to man. Leviticus 13, verse 29. It says, "Now if a man or woman has an infection on the head or on the beard." Now, granted, this is dealing with Israelites here, what this man would call the descendants of Adam kind, or the Adam-ish of Genesis 2. But the point is that it's being used simply to distinguish between man and woman. Male and female is how it's being used. Now, that doesn't necessarily show a lot other than what I showed in Genesis with the animals. But it gets a little bit rougher on his theory here. Let's go to Leviticus now. Leviticus chapter 24. And observe how the word ish is used in these passages. Leviticus 24, verses 15 and 16. It says, "And you shall speak to the sons of Israel, saying, if anyone curses his God, then he shall bear his sin. Moreover, the one who blasphemes the name of Yahweh shall surely be put to death. All the congregation shall stone him, the alien as well as the native. When he blasphemes the name, shall be put to death." The word
In King James, it's whosoever blasphemes the name. In the New American Standard, the one who blasphemes the name. That's the word each, the one, the man, the or whosoever, according to King James, is the each of this passage. But notice who is the each. Whether they be Israel, the native, or the alien. In this case, it's the Hebrew word ger. And as we saw in one of our previous messages in the First Commandment series, ger often means and is used interchangeably with Nakri and means non-Israelites. And that the point of this would make no sense if it was anything else. That the alien, whether he be a Hebrew or Israelite that is from another country, that's abiding in the Israel's common land, or whether it be a non-Israelite who has joined himself to Yahweh and is abiding there, he still is under the same law. And thus the man here meant not just Israelite or Adam kind, but anyone of any other race as well. His theory has just gone out the window. Not only that, I want to go to one more passage here. 2 Kings, and this one really puts a clincher on it. 2 Kings verse chapter 18 and verse 33. It says, "Has any one of the gods of the nations delivered his land from the hand of the king of Assyria?" Read the passage, it's dealing with idolatry. It's chastising these people for thinking that, or excuse me, this has got to be the Assyrian king who is chastising Hezekiah and saying, your God is no different than the rest of these gods out here for these other nations who weren't able to deliver these other nations from my hand. So why do you think your God is going to be? It's talking about the gods of these non-Israelite nations, these idolatrous nations. The word any is each in there. Has any one of these gods? What's the any? The false gods, the idols. And so certainly his theory has gone out the window. In Job 31, verse 35, the word ish is translated adversary. In Proverbs 6 and verse 26, the word ish is translated adulteress. In Proverbs 19, 22 and 30, verse 6, the word ish is translated liar. And then it's also used for Philistines, Amalekites, and Syrians in the Scriptures as well. His theory just indeed will not hold water. He also was implying that we need to look at the word Adam, 120 as it's used, and to see if it's ever used for anyone other than the common Adam or these other races. Well, I did that as well. Simply did what he suggested, looked at the Scriptures, and here's some Scriptures to consider in this light. Exodus 13, quickly, running out of time. Exodus 13, and listen to verse 2. It says, "Sanctify to me every firstborn, the first offspring of every womb among the sons of Israel." He says that 120 is used only for non-Israelites when translated Adam or man. But here, very clearly, the word man is dealing specifically with Israelites. And then in Leviticus chapter 1. Well, I'm not going to read it because we're out of time, but Leviticus 1:2, you'll find another case, and there are many more cases throughout the rest of the Old Testament Scriptures that prove that Adam is dealing with Israelite people, which completely blows his theory. And then we have the other side, and that is that Ish is oftentimes dealing with non-Israelite people. So his theory is completely blown. As a result of examining these different arguments, which supposedly prove that man of Genesis 1 is the creation of different races, we can see that they have no validity whatsoever. This is certain. The man of Genesis 1 and the Adam of Genesis 2 are both translated from the same Hebrew word Adam. Consequently, the Adam of Genesis 1 and the man of Genesis 2 are both one and the same creature or being. Therefore, we can put to rest this idea that man of Genesis 1:26 is the creation of the other races of mankind.